This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, horticulturist Ron Smith tackles lawn and garden issues as we transition into the fall season. And also coming right up is election season. And joining me now is Brian Crocius. He is the chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Ashley. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
This is another of our Meet the Candidates series for anyone running in a statewide election. Brian, what do you think most people don't understand about what the Public Service Commission does?
Well, that's a good question. There are so many different areas that we do cover from a jurisdictional standpoint, things we're involved with, different responsibilities. And sometimes I think in the mind of the public, that extends to other areas that we may not be as involved with. Which is understandable because you would literally need a roadmap to know what agency does it. But it's a mix. There are some things that the federal agencies are responsible for and then some things at the state level that we're responsible for. We're involved, for example, with rail safety, with pipeline safety. Rail safety, that's in coordination with the federal government, federal authorities. And even on the pipeline side, we work closely with PHMSA, another federal agency as well. And we work with them on the pipeline side for gas pipelines, not crude oil, but gas pipelines when it comes to safety. But I think that would be a good example because I think sometimes from a safety standpoint, inspection standpoint, people might think that because we do the siting on the crude oil side, that we're also in charge with the inspection side of it after the pipeline is in the ground. So things like that, but it's understandable because it can be quite complicated and a little complex at times.
And it is a three-person body, three-member body, and really more of a regulatory commission, not so much on the legislative end, correct?
That is correct, and that's another good point. From a regulatory standpoint, that's where our jurisdiction lies, and we're not lawmakers. We can't change the law. We have to follow the law. And it doesn't always mean that philosophically we may agree with how laws are written, although generally I think that is the case. But there are exceptions at times just based on personal preference. But as I've often told people, it's not about the rule of personal preference. It's about the rule of law.
Do you ever work with the legislative bodies here? Maybe would they consult you, for example, before passing any laws?
Yes, we will actually go and testify upon request. On occasion, the agency will put forth a bill, and it's usually related to something that we may view as a deficiency in how a law might be written, something that might need to be clarified in statute, and just something to help the process go a little bit smoother, and also to provide clarity to the public as well. And that's really, for the most part, our involvement. But I think you have to be careful when it comes to creating law or being involved with how laws are written, particularly when you're going to be ruling on that aspect of the law. So I think it's about balance and just being cognizant that at some point in time, we're going to have to take a vote on a law that has been passed by the legislature. And our involvement, I think, should be limited in that respect.
How does your background shape your approach to chairing the PSC?
Well, I think my background is it's been described as very North Dakotan. I was born in Fargo. I attended NDSU, started working in college, actually throughout college to help pay the bills, of course. But I'm a father, I'm a landowner, I have a ranch and cattle and grain operation out in the western part of the state. So I understand things as a landowner, as a parent, as someone who's spent his entire working career in the state. And, you know, I go through the same trials and tribulations as anyone else. And I really apply that experience to how I view cases. And of course, it's based on law. But when I'm hearing people at different events and hearing what they have to say, I can certainly relate to what life is like living in North Dakota. It really is a great place.
What happens on the PSC? So there are three members, of course, so that you don't have a tie vote when it comes to some of these issues that come up before the PSC. And so I'm thinking of, for example, earlier this year, you and fellow commissioners voted on siting permits for the Russo Wind Project. And this came down to a 2-1 vote with Commissioner Fedorchuk voting in favor of allowing the siting permits, and then you and Randy voting against the permitting. And I'm wondering, just what is your strategy? I mean, for when it's a 2-1 vote, you know, if it was a jury, you always try to convince everybody on the jury to vote in the way that you are going. When it's something like this, is it just a simple majority rules and then that's it?
Right. It's a majority rules. So two votes, of course, would be more than one. And, you know, the commissioners, different commissioners, will see things a little bit differently at times. And in that case, you know, quite differently. And sometimes it gets into just how laws are written and trying to interpret legislative intent. Mm. In that particular case, it was about lighting, and it was a new law passed in the last session, and it said that the facilities must have lighting. Mm-hmm. And while that may not have been legislative intent to knock exceptions due to military concerns, it wasn't written that way in the law. So I think that's something that will be circled around back on in the next session. And I think lawmakers will address that. But usually when, well, not usually, but actually almost always when I'm making these types of decisions, I'll consult with legal and ask them a number of questions and just do the research. And then we all come to our own conclusions on the commission at the end of the day, and we can't talk amongst each other. Unless it's noticed to the public in a work session. So it's just, you know, sometimes there's going to be a difference of opinion, and I think that's a very healthy thing to have that contrast on the commission and that we're challenging each other's thought processes and ideas. I think the end product is much better that way.
You know, I think of that concept of just deciding intent or interpreting intent, and that can be a very tricky thing to do with language, is the same exact words could read one way to one person and another way to another person, or even just like literally from a grammatical standpoint. There's, you know, famous cases of people getting out of parking tickets because of a misplaced comma or what have you. Just the idea of intent. I know you said you talked to legal and what have you, but I mean, what is your approach for how you decide what someone else was thinking when they wrote something down?
Well, I think a good example of that would be the prime farmland rule is what it was called. And it was related to a solar facility, which was sited. They have the permit. The developer has the permit. And it would actually be near Castleton, North Dakota. And there was a rule in place about prime farmland. And the language, I thought, was somewhat vague in terms of what classifies or would be considered a measurable amount of prime farmland in a particular area. And I went back to microfish back from the 80s and late 70s. That was for the documentation, and actually read through testimony. And it was about 200 pages, I want to say, of testimony. And that's something I spent the time. I read through it. And you hear what the different commissioners said back then. And because it was a rule that was put in place by the commission, mm-hmm. granted, you know, the authority was granted by the legislature to do that. So it's a lot of homework. And I've described it to family members. It's kind of like going back to college, where you're doing a lot of studying. And you're looking back at statute and also rules put in place 20, 30, 40 years ago. And that's really, I think, how you make that proper determination, by reading past testimony. So it can be tedious, but interesting at the same time, but very tedious. But it has to be done. It's an important part of the job.
We're visiting today with Brian Crocius. He is chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission, appointed back in March of 2017 by Governor Doug Burgum and elected in 2018 and now seeking re-election in the 2020 election. And you can find out more at briancrocius.com, and that's K-R-O-S-H-U-S. Brian, what are your top priorities to address if elected and serving for the next 6 years?
They're going to continue to be what I ran on in the first place and why I said yes when the governor called. As you mentioned, back in March of 2017, 3.5 years ago, when he called, I had thoughts in mind in terms of what I wanted to accomplish. And at the top of the list is to make sure that North Dakotans have access to reliable and affordable energy, both electricity and natural gas. We have some of the best rates in the country. We want to make sure we keep it that way. But the other part as a landowner would be responsible infrastructure development and ensuring that companies that want to do business in North Dakota are doing it correctly and being good stewards of the environment. But I also think we have an obligation as a commission to make sure that we bring them into compliance with an application and that it meets the requirements as set forth in law. So applications never come in, for example, in a perfect format. Rarely are they exactly the way they need to be in order to get permitted. And we'll tell companies, here are the deficiencies. We'll work with them. They have to correct them, and as they almost always do. But then we're off on, it's a really good start. It's a solid foundation. And then that just creates opportunities for local communities. It helps expand their tax base when facilities are sited. So that continues to be an important part of the job and a priority of mine, responsible infrastructure development, and also just public safety through the rail programs, through the North Dakota One Call. We're heavily involved with North Dakota One Call, and we want to make sure people are safe, whether it's a homeowner or a commercial excavator, safe out in the field, and that they're keeping the public safe. So it's really about a number of different things, but it's about setting the table ultimately so future generations benefit from the work we're doing, and we leave things in a better state than where they're currently at and what we inherited. So, and I do that from the perspective of not only a North Dakotan, but also as a father. I want my children to be able to continue working in the state, and I want to see good opportunities for them.
You just mentioned being responsible stewards of the land, and since you were first appointed, there has been a change in reporting for oil spills that has dramatically changed the threshold that needs to be reported, and a report that I'm looking at from the Billings Gazette that looked at information compiled by the forum says that upwards of 80% of those spills would no longer have to be reported based on the new amounts. How did those two things sit in your mind as being responsible stewards of the land and also changing the threshold so that fewer oil spills have to be reported?
Well, I wasn't involved in the conversations that I think that was both the Industrial Commission, Department of Mineral Resources would have worked on that. And I think more specifically, the Industrial Commission, that's not an area of jurisdiction for the Public Service Commission. But using that as an example, I think transparency is really important. And I think the public has a right to know what's going on with industry. So when I look at the reporting side on natural gas, for example, which we are responsible for, anything we can do to increase transparency, let the public know when an incident does occur, because at times they will, invariably, whether operator area, error, or a mechanical failure, I think it's really important to let the public know what the state is up to from an oversight standpoint and how we're going about things.
So how do you increase that transparency?
Well, one thing we do at the commission, we notice all of our meetings. We make sure that the public knows that if we're going to be talking about something, that they're more than welcome to listen in or prior to COVID, attend in person.
Right.
Approaching that a little bit differently these days. But I think it's just about having an honest conversation with the public and letting them know at any given time, this is what we're working on. These are the challenges. These are the opportunities to improve, and seeking public input. That's something that I do and the commission does on a continuous basis. We want to hear from the public. We want to know what is occurring out where they live and how they think we might be able to go about things in a little better fashion. And one thing I do, it goes, you know, comes down to accessibility. I make my personal cell phone available on my campaign website, on my Facebook page, and I've told people over and over again, never hesitate to call. You can reach me at the Capitol, at my office, but I'm always accessible by cell phone as well. And I think that's an important step, that we're making ourselves available to the public so we can interact with them and that they expect us to.
You know, I'm curious, you talked about those public hearings, and of course they used to be in person, and during COVID, some in-person things have obviously changed dramatically. Have you noticed at all a change in participation as things have moved over to more electronically? Has it been easier, for example, people to attend, or maybe harder because they already have too many other things to do now?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. I think from an accessibility standpoint, it's actually improved by putting a greater focus on the electronic access to our meetings, to our hearings. And we post that right on the homepage of the North Dakota Public Service Commission website. And we want people to know that you're more than welcome and encouraged, frankly, to listen to what we have to say, what we're up to, the cases that are in front of us. So one great example would be at a recent siting case that we had a hearing. Typically, people would have to be there in person or dial-in access, et cetera, just wasn't really a top-of-mind thing. We'd go to the county that the hearing was in, or actually the facility would be sited in. But now people can just call in instead of making a one-hour, one-and-a-half-hour trip or taking an afternoon or an entire day, for that matter, to attend the hearing. And we actually had a farmer. It was during spring planting. A farmer called in from the tractor of his cab.
Oh, wow.
Or the cab of his tractor, I should say, and provided public testimony and would not have been able to do that in all likelihood from a practical standpoint without electronic access. That's helped quite a bit.
I'm on the public awareness, the consumer information tab on the PSC's website, and that's psc.nd.gov. And right away, it starts with how the Public Service Commission can sometimes help out with people who, for example, are applying for telephone assistance or some billing issues, and maybe intervene before their gas or electricity is disconnected. And I'm wondering, as we're sitting in the midst of a global pandemic and we're heading right into the cold winter months, what, if anything, can you do to strengthen North Dakota's most vulnerable citizens against possibly losing that connection to heat, if jobs are insecure at this time?
Right. We continue to work very closely with utility companies under our jurisdiction, which would be the publicly traded companies. We continue to work with them on both electricity and gas service and customers that are facing a financial hardship because of COVID-19. And it's something we take very seriously. So we continue to work with them. Disconnects were suspended for quite some time. That they just simply weren't going to disconnect customers that had fallen behind in payments. And now they're working with those customers that might be facing those difficulties, working with them on payment plans and other mechanisms to make sure that services continue to be provided to them. So it's an incredibly important thing. I think the companies that we're working with, I've talked to them numerous times on this topic. They're very cognizant of the impact it would have, and I think are doing the right things to work with folks that might have those types of issues and challenges right now from a financial standpoint. So the short answer is we're staying very close to the utility companies on that particular matter to make sure that services continue to be provided.
As more North Dakotans are working from home and students are going to school over Zoom, what is your position when it comes to the internet availability in the state? I know there's a big push for broadband internet, and that wasn't listed in your top priorities.
No, that wasn't listed as a top priority, and it's not that it isn't important, but in terms of you had asked a question earlier on one of the challenges of being on the commission, I think was the point you were making. What does the public know about what we do and what's jurisdictional? Broadband deployment is not jurisdictional to the Public Service Commission. That is jurisdictional to the FCC, and the grant program is administered through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So we work with Lifeline Service. That's what we do with telecom. We're not in charge of broadband deployment, but I do have to give a shout out to the telecom providers, the North Dakota Broadband Association in particular. Just a recent article in May, just of this current year, 2020, it was a story, why does North Dakota have the best internet in the United States? And two out of three rural households have access to high-speed internet through fiber that's being deployed out in the countryside. And when you look at the rest of the country, that number is one out of five. So we're close to 70%. The rest of the country is sitting at 20%. So more work to do by the Broadband Association, but they've done a heck of a job deploying broadband in the across the rural area. And when we have better broadband, as the article states, than cities like Chicago, in our rural areas, I think that's a testament to the job they're doing.
I've been intrigued that in the history of the North Dakota PSC, there's only been one Democrat who was ever elected. And I'm wondering why, for starters, I guess, why do you even need to be a declared member, and you're a declared member of the Republican Party, if you're only a regulating body and not a legislating body?
Well, I think the biggest reason is it's, frankly, it's how you get on the ballot. You have to declare as either a Republican or a Democrat or an independent, I think there would be the Libertarian Party as well. So,
but if it weren't for that, do you really need to have affiliation to a political party?
No, I don't think you have to be affiliated with a political party. I happen to be, conservative minded, but it's really a nonpartisan post. The work we do would be considered nonpartisan. We don't serve just one party or just one group of North Dakotans. We serve all North Dakotans. My constituents, it doesn't matter what their political affiliation is. I serve them all the same. That's what I'm tasked with. Representing the entire state, and I think that's one of the qualities that I bring into the office each and every day, and I think it's really important for anyone serving on the Public Service Commission to view it that way, and I believe we all do.
Brian Kroschus is chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission and is seeking re-election. You can find out more at briankroschus.com. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time.
Still to come on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state's Industrial Commission has approved a Phase 2 for further coronavirus business aid administered by the Bank of North Dakota. Here's Prairie Public's Dave Thompson.
This proposal sets aside $50 million for businesses that look for existing debt forgiveness. It would be a grant program, and it's a change in a proposal the bank submitted in August for $100 million in loan interest rate forgiveness. That was presented as a concept. The money comes from the Federal CARES Act. That proposal was shelved, with legislators on the commission not very comfortable voting on a concept. Hardmire told the commission businesses would be asked what their revenue loss was from April 1st to October 1st, as compared to the previous year, and the businesses would receive up to $50,000 in grants. The program would be administered through local banks. Hardmire City's been talking to local banks and businesses around the state about this.
And I know a number of you have talked to bankers, business owners, and have, you know, concluded the same, that this program that is going to have a lot of interest for a lot of companies.
House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jeff Delzer said he would have preferred that the program begin at $25 or $30 million, and if the demand is there, then more money could be allocated.
I don't see any reason to have the 50 sitting there to start it when you can start it at 25 or 30.
The original proposal was to accept applications through October 1st, then have the money sent out by December 31st. But Governor Doug Burgum suggested that the time frame be shortened so that it would be a 4 to 6 week application period. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner moved for the $50 million amount.
No question that this is going to help get our businesses back on their feet and get our economy going.
The vote was 4-2. The no votes came from Delzer and House Majority Leader Chet Pollard. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And thousands of workers are being hired to help with a sugar beet harvest in the Red River Valley over the next several weeks. The risk of COVID-19 is a big concern this year. American Crystal Sugar is requiring masks and is changing procedures in an effort to slow the spread of the coronavirus. American Crystal Vice President for Agriculture Brian Engelsrud says workers are trained on safety around equipment every year.
With COVID, there's a whole new set of issues that you have to start thinking about. And you know, one of them is, when you start socializing, when you get closer than 6 feet apart from each other, outside even, you got to get that mask on.
Engelsrud says there's only a short time to bring in the harvest, and COVID outbreaks among workers could cause delays. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is horticulturist Ron Smith. It's time to check in and see what we should be doing in, boy, this quick onset fall.
Yeah, suddenly.
Yeah.
Like somebody opened the windows too quickly.
Yeah, seriously. And it got a little too cold for the last day of bike riding on that Labor Day. And I thought, wow, all right. So it does make me wonder, is it already too late to do some of the fall yard work things?
No. It just is going to accelerate our desire to get it done.
Right.
One of the nice things about this is that it discourages mosquito activity when it's cold out, chilly out. Like it is, it also slows down the activity of yellow jackets. It doesn't kill them yet. They need a killing frost of about 28 degrees overnight, or for at least a couple of hours in the early morning hours to do that. But it's invigorating to be working outside at this time of the year or under these kind of temperature conditions, because you can go ahead and work with very few pests, in the sense that we're used to having pests out there, and you don't get too hot, you don't get overworked.
Oh, I don't know. It feels like cocoa weather to me.
Yeah. It almost makes you want to go ahead and get your snowblower tuned up.
Well, let's not be ridiculous.
Yeah, I know it is. It is ridiculous. But what it does is it accelerates your desire to get your vegetable garden, tomatoes and peppers, plants like that, harvested before the frost comes in and takes them out.
Yeah, let's focus on those tomatoes in particular. Is it okay? Mm-hmm. So I noticed overnight temperatures for where I live for tonight are supposed to be in about 35, 36. Should I be harvesting every tomato possible today, or will I be okay just throwing some blankets over the tomatoes for a couple more days?
I would suggest throwing some blankets over the tomatoes because that's going to be spotty, that those temperatures are. And everybody has a microclimate, and you can say, well, my microclimate's not going to get that cold, but it just might. But throwing a blanket or a sheet over them, some kind of a cover over them, will keep them protected enough to keep from being damaged. Harvesting every tomato you can, you're bound to bring in some immature tomatoes, and they aren't going to do anything for you once you remove them from the vine. but just rot where you set them.
Okay.
So you're better off leaving them on the vine as long as you possibly can. And if they start to color up, then you can go ahead and bring them in, and then they will continue to ripen once you bring them inside. But if you bring them in too soon, too green, they will just sit there and rot green, and you'll regret it. So don't be too anxious to do that. If you've grown sweet peppers, the sweet bell peppers, which usually have a nice green character to them, my wife's peppers have begun turning red, and they're absolutely beautiful. The pepper plants look like small Christmas trees with red Christmas balls on them. So that's if we're going to protect ours tonight as well, to make sure that they are able to stay on the plant and continue to ripen and get that nice red color, because she freezes the red sweet peppers for the winter when they're about $2.50 per pepper. So that's better than money in the bank, really. If you like, red peppers, not the hot kind, but the red peppers for coloring up your salads or your pizzas.
How about for fall bulbs right now?
Yeah, bulb planting this is the time of the year in our part of the country. And this would be a good time to go out and visit the local garden centers, the garden supply stores, and hopefully they will have bulbs separated out so you can hand pick them yourself. I don't encourage people to write away to catalogs to have bulbs shipped out, because typically, it's been my experience, they send them too late. And what we want to do is get them in the ground while the soil temperature is above 40 degrees, which it will be for quite some time. That encourages root growth and establishment, and then they'll take off and grow very nicely for us this next spring. They'll actually be pushing the snow out of the way when they start coming up. And that's very nice to see the very stubborn tulips and daffodils and crocuses.
Yeah, it's making, always delightful.
Making their stand against winter. You know that winter is
right.
Being challenged, and it's not going to be around much longer once you see those showing up. So this is a perfect time. Between now and the end of September is a good time, Ashley. So they have to the end of the month to do it, but don't wait, because the best bulbs are always picked out first.
Oh, sure. How about some of those plants, I want to say gladiolas, but I might be wrong, where they can survive here, but they need to be dug up and taken in the winter and then replanted in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
What's the process for that?
Yeah, it's a lot more work, of course, to do that. And you take the chance of perpetuating any kind of a disease or pest that might be associated with those. And you need to dry them completely, brush the dirt off, and put them away in a paper bag, not a plastic bag, but a paper bag in a cool, dark location. And, just check them frequently to make sure that they aren't decaying on you or getting moldy or mildewy, and they should be okay. That's the best advice I can give you on those if you like plants.
What are some other things we should be doing in this first half of September?
Well, the first half of September, I would say analyze your lawn. Are you happy with it? If you are, just keep mowing it. And you're going to notice you're not going to have to mow it as often with the cooler temperatures, because the grass slows down because of the cooler temperatures and the shorter days that we're having, the day length that we're experiencing right now. So that's good. If your lawn needs weed control, it's a perfect time to go ahead and do it. Typical dandelions and plantain, broadleaf plantain weeds, any kind of a broadleaf weed is a perfect time to go ahead and do that, because you're not having the soft, tender growth that you get in the spring that makes making weed control a little bit more tricky to do. So this is the perfect time to go ahead and get that application down to get your broadleaf weeds out of the way. And then if your lawn has not responded to typical fertilization practices, then it might be compacted, might need core aeration. And if you have heavy thatch, you might couple that core aeration with dethatching and then overseeding. And you have until the end of September to go ahead and do that. If you get into October, then wait until, I would say, mid-October, and then put the seed down for what we'd call dormant seeding. The seed will just sit there imbibing water, priming itself to go ahead and germinate and grow early next spring. But this is the perfect time to do it. And your last mowing, whether it be in September or October, should be about one notch shorter than you're normally mowing it now. I don't want to tell people to drop it all the way down because you'll end up scalping your lawn. But just if you've been mowing it at 3 inches, take a look at your mower. There's notches there. Go ahead and drop it one notch lower so that you can pick up most of the grass that you cut without any scalping. And that'll discourage disease problems and bull activity because they don't like short grass. They like the longer grass to go.
They can hide. Yeah.
Yes, they can hide. Yes, they're sneaky little bounders.
How about some transplanting right now? Can we be transplanting anything?
Yeah, there's two definitions. There's planting and transplanting. The nurseries, the garden centers are having sales on their woody plants these days. It would behoove the intended gardener, the intended landscaper, to get out there and take a look at them because they're 15 to 25% off on some woody plants. They want to get those things cleared out. They don't want to have to babysit them themselves through the winter months, especially your private garden centers. And so this is a good time. If you've always wanted an apple tree in your backyard, now's the time to do it. It'll transplant beautifully. It'll plant beautifully for you. Get a good root system established and take off and do its thing beautifully next spring. It's unfortunate, Ashley, that we are the way we are as human beings. We say, well, the end of the summer, the mosquitoes have driven me crazy. The yellow jackets have chased me into the house. It's cooling off. Now I can relax, clean out my garden, cut the grass, pick up the leaves as they come down, and I'm done. And we don't think beyond that typically, but that you possibly can look at your yard and say, what is it I want to plant so they have it next year around for years to come? This is the best time. There's no better time to do woody plant planting than the fall. Now, as far as transplanting goes, once we've had a couple of good frosts where the growth has slowed down, you don't have to worry about it, and they're starting to drop their leaves. If you have a plant that you want to move, plant A or plant B, from one spot to another, go ahead and do that. And that applies to your herbaceous plants as well as your woody plants. So it's perfect to go ahead and do it at the time that you get a couple more nippy days like we've had here the past 24 hours. So transplanting is when you dig things up and move them to another spot, and you want to try to dig as much of the root ball as you possibly reasonably can. If it's a hardy plant, you don't really have to worry about it. Most of them will go ahead and survive. Hydrangeas are very good at surviving being moved around. Most herbaceous perennials are good at being moved around too at this time of year. So it's a good time to go ahead and do that. Just move them into that new spot, water them in once, and then forget about them. They'll be okay through the remainder of the fall and going into the winter.
Okay, right. So I get it for transplanting. You're totally moving a plant. But if you're thinning something like irises or lilies that just every few years they get too thick and you need to thin them out. For starters, is this the right time of year to be thinning? And then if so, can you accidentally overthin those?
Can you accidentally overthin daylilies and iris? Boy, if you can, write a book about it because it's been my experience. Maybe other people have done it. Maybe you have, Ashley. I don't know. But it's once daylilies get in there, it takes a couple of years to get them. If you want to move them out, they've just become too intense. You don't want daylilies there anymore because it's gotten too shady. They've gotten too crowded. They've gotten too dense. You say, well, I'm going to clean them out and put something else in there that's not going to be as much work. And bingo, you end up with, where'd that daylily come from? How did that iris remain there? I thought I got them all out.
Yeah.
So you'll have at least a couple years of quote-unquote thinning these out where you don't want them to be. So,
and is that more of a fall thing or a spring thing for those?
No, it's a fall thing. Good time to do it this time of year. Yep.
Okay. And I'm assuming unless it's absolutely urgent, we shouldn't be doing any tree trimming.
Yes, absolutely. We're past the season for trimming now, even though you'll see some arborists out still doing some pruning. It's probably because the homeowner is concerned about heavy branches or branches that are broken already, and they want to go ahead and get those taken out before they come down when you don't expect it. But from a standpoint of pruning, it should be strictly functional pruning at this time of year where you need it for safety purposes, security purposes, whatever. So that would be the reason to go ahead and do pruning like that. Cutting plants back like hydrangeas, this would be the perfect time of the year to go ahead and do something like that. The hydrangeas that flower on new wood every year, you might as well cut them back, because if you don't do it, the rabbits are going to do it for you. And they'll eat them right down to the nub. But fortunately, they don't kill the plants. They come right back for you the following spring.
Ron, we started out this segment talking about how to protect tomatoes, but other plants need to be protected as we go into winter, like roses. Do we need to be doing that this early?
No, a little bit later.
Okay.
That you can push to the end of the month, the beginning of October, and you can protect them by putting a mound of soil over the crown, over the graft, and that would be the easiest thing to do. If you have marginal roses, if you have cold hardy roses from Canada, you can just leave them alone. they'll be okay. That's right. Been my luck that they come back every year, no matter what we go through. Usually a snow cover is enough of a mulch to protect them from the extreme colds. Let me think here. What else? Leaf removal, Ashley. They're starting to drop. As the leaves come down, get them off the lawn, get them to the recycling bins where they can put them to good use. Don't wait until they smother the lawn and you keep saying, well, I'm going to wait until every leaf has dropped off before I get out there and do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've been there.
And you might get away with it, but you might not. And when you say, well, this weekend I'm going to go out and get those leaves cleaned up, and that's the weekend that you get a good 6 inches of snow and you mash them into the soil and they're harder to pick up. And you just say, the heck with it, I'm going to leave it there until next spring. And that's when you start running into problems with your lawn as well. So all kinds of little balancing acts you have to go through. One of the other things I want to mention, I want to talk about pesty bugs, not dangerous bugs, but pesty bugs, fruit flies, especially.
So many.
You can buy fruit fly traps or you can get yellow sticky tape at the local garden center, and their brain power isn't very, very strong, so they'll fly around and land on it. And that'll thin them out quite a bit. But you can also buy traps that'll pull the fruit flies into the trap, and that's it. It's not toxic to have in the house at all.
Yeah.
Don't ask me the question that I'm afraid you're going to ask me. Where do they come from? They come from overripe fruit. And how did they get to the overripe fruit? They were a part of it, I guess, somewhere, somehow, some way. No matter how clean the fruit is, the doggone things show up. If you have peaches that have gone beyond being too ripe, tomatoes that have gone beyond being too ripe, bananas especially, they seem to show up there, and they can be annoying. They aren't harmful. They just are annoying. And so that's something to watch out for. And then the other characters harvesting, agronomic harvesting taking place. The Oriental ladybug that has been imported to control aphids on some of our agronomic crops. As they get harvested, they move on to other food sources, and they don't like the cold weather either. So they try to get in right along with the box elder bugs. And so the best thing you can do if they get into your house is to vacuum them up. Rather than trying to apply some kind of an insecticide to control them, just vacuum them up when you see them, and let it go with that. They aren't going to hurt you. Oh, the little ladybugs will give you a nip, make you realize that they're there.
Yeah.
But they aren't going to cause any major problems like a sting from a yellow jacket would. But just vacuum them up and then try to find out where they're coming in. If they're following you in the house, then close your door quickly behind you. If you have little holes in your screens or along your windowsill, get that patched up as quickly as you can. They're just annoying.
I've never been quite brave enough to do it, but for Halloween, for several years, I've said I want to be an Asian lady beetle because I can just wear a ladybug costume, but then go up and bite people. be really funny. But especially during a pandemic, maybe I won't do that again.
Yeah, maybe not this year. Put that off until after the pandemic has passed.
You know, I have noticed that there are certain scents that they don't like. Like, I burn a lot of sage around my house and mm-hmm. sometimes dried rosemary, just, you know, some dried herbs you can put in a little thing and mm-hmm. have a small fire in a proper bowl around your house. And then, for example, I will have the lady beetles in my bedroom, but I never have them in my yoga room. And that's where I burn all this incense and sage. And so mm-hmm. I don't know, mm-hmm. is that normal that they just don't like those smells, or is it the smoke?
No, that could be both. I think it's probably, they're very sensitive to aromas. Most bugs, I'm not an entomologist, so I can't speak with any authority, but I am told, or I've been led to understand, that they have a sense of recognition of odors, aromas, and some of them are very attractive and others are not. And they stay away from the ones that they consider unattractive to them. And of course, the smoke that would be coming from them would be an irritant as well. So it could be a combination of the two things, actually.
Sure.
Whatever it is, it's working.
Just the last minute here, in terms of bringing some plants that we have outside during the warm months and then right. we want to bring them into the house, do we need to be checking for any of these bugs?
Yeah, it's a good idea to have an area of your home or your garage that you can bring them in. We've done that already with our house plants, brought them in into the garage, and then as it gets too cold to leave them out during the day, we're going to bring them into the garage and then bring them into the basement where we can kind of keep an eye on them for about a week, you know, confine them to see what happens to bloom or break out of the pots or start crawling across the floor in the basement where we can catch them and do something to prevent that from happening. If you really, really want to be gung-ho, you can go ahead and knock your plants out of the pot, check the root ball, maybe thin it out a little bit, put some fresh potting soil in there, and then repot them again. But still go ahead and keep them in a kind of a quarantine area where if things start to fly or crawl across your floor or around on the plant inside the house, then you know that you have a problem. But generally speaking, most of our tough houseplants are pretty resilient and are not that attractive to really pesty pests. We have a couple of plants, the airplane plant and the wandering Jew or Tritiscantha. We've had those two plants in our house since we moved here. And we've never had any, I shouldn't say this, I know I shouldn't say it, we've never had any trouble with bugs in them. But Betsy checks them very carefully, makes sure that there's nothing there because she can't stand bugs in her house. And I don't blame her. But she checks them very carefully, and she's never had any major problems with them showing up. So,
horticulturist Ron Smith joins us during the growing season. You can email your questions to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Ron, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Talk to you again.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is proud to be the media sponsor of the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl, October 3rd and 4th, noon to 6 p.m. See Fargo-Moorhead artists at work. Ask questions and perhaps be inspired to create your own art. Find a map to begin your tour at prairiepublic.org.
When you hear arts programming on Prairie Public, know that it's supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 8th, celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
On November 3rd of 1914, voters in North Dakota had the opportunity to pass women's suffrage, and on this date, suffragists were actively campaigning for this change. In Fargo, local suffragist Kate S. Wilder gave suffrage speeches in several Women's Christian Temperance Union districts. Valley City's Votes for Women League planned for a strenuous campaign in the fall. Every Saturday was to be a Woman's Day through November 3rd. Mrs. Antoinette Funk, national suffrage worker, campaigned in North Dakota for a week in September. Prominent suffragist Dr. Anna Howard Shaw also lectured around the state that month. While she was in Valley City, a street meeting was held, and in Bismarck, she appeared at the Armory, where she dismissed arguments against suffrage, as well as recent accusations from anti-suffragists that she wanted to eliminate the marriage ceremony. In Hope, the Equal Suffrage League held their first public meeting in January 1914. The place was crowded, with speakers including Mr. E. S. Shippey, whose wife would become president of the group, and Mr. E. D. Washburn. The two men, quote, handled the various objections raised against women's suffrage without mercy, end quote. Songs were also part of many suffrage events, with tunes such as this one. Votes for North Dakota women, sing it loud and clear. Sing it till the sleeping ones shall waken up and cheer. Half a score of suffrage states are sending us a cheer. While we are marching to victory, hurrah, hurrah, we'll bring the jubilee. Hurrah, hurrah, we women shall be free. So we sing the chorus while with vision free, we see votes for handy women. Suffragists might also sing a stanza or more of this song, which was composed by Dr. Max Batt of Fargo. Oh, suffrage, liberty, women's equality, of these we sing. Thought short may be the fight for any woman's right, that victory be in sight, we pray and sing. This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota. Support is provided by Benedictine Living Community of Wahpeton, where health, independence, and choice come to life through skilled nursing care, short-stay rehabilitation, assisted living, basic care, and home care. A member of the Benedictine Health System, blcwahpeton.org.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we meet a UND professor who is the newest president of the American Society of Parasitologists, overseeing some 700 scientists studying parasites. Also tomorrow, September is Hunger Action Month, and it is particularly meaningful during a global pandemic. And we visit with Karen Ahrens of the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.